I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the UN demands the unconditional release of Golan peacekeepers. Hundreds of thousands of Syrian children are missing out on school.
Many parents are now reluctant to send their children to school because of fears for their safety.
Egypt braces for more unrest over a football riot case. And the U.S. says Iran is committed to deception, defiance, and delay. It's all ahead. Security Council has voted in favor of a U.S.-drafted resolution to impose some of the strongest sanctions ever ordered by the United Nations. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Susan Rice afterwards spoke with reporters.
The strength, breadth, and severity of these sanctions will raise the cost to North Korea of its illicit nuclear program and further constrain its ability to finance and source materials and technology for its ballistic missile, conventional, and nuclear weapons program. First, Resolution 2094 imposes tough new financial sanctions. When North Korea tries to move money to pay for its nuclear and ballistic missile programs, countries must now block those transfers, even if the money is being carried in suitcases full of bulk cash. Likewise, North Korean banks will find it much harder to launder money for the DPRK nuclear program. Today's resolution also imposes new travel restrictions. If, for example, a North Korean agent is caught making arms deals or selling nuclear technology, countries will be required to expel that agent. Countries must also now prevent the travel of people working for designated companies involved in the nuclear and missile programs. States will now have new authorities to inspect cargo and stop North Korean arms smuggling and proliferation. If a country has cargo on its territory that might be carrying prohibitive items like conventional arms or nuclear or ballistic materials, this resolution requires that the cargo be inspected. It will also make it harder for North Korean vessels to offload such prohibited cargo if a ship refuses inspection on the high seas, thus forcing it to return to its port of origin. And airplanes carrying smuggled items can find themselves grounded. This resolution will also counter North Korean efforts to abuse diplomatic privileges to advance its nuclear and ballistic missile activities. It will now be much harder for such diplomats to procure technology or divert funds to the nuclear program without being detected and expelled.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Susan Rice. Meanwhile, North Korea threatened a preemptive nuclear strike on the United States. The North's foreign ministry today said the move was necessary because the United States is about to ignite a nuclear war. North Korea has made recent strides in its nuclear and missile programs, but is not believed to have the ability to launch a long-range rocket with a nuclear warhead. It regularly makes such statements at times of heightened tension on the Korean Peninsula. The commander of U.S. forces in South Korea released a statement saying he is concerned about Pyongyang's threat and warns he is ready to defend South Korea and fully enforce the conditions of the armistice. The UN Security Council is demanding the unconditional release of more than 20 peacekeepers stopped and detained by armed elements of the Syrian opposition in the Golan Heights. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has details.
The United Nations says a group of peacekeepers from its disengagement observer force, known as UNDOF, in the area of separation between Israel and Syria, were seized by a group of some 30 armed fighters Wednesday. A UN spokesman said the unarmed peacekeepers were on a regular supply mission when they were stopped near an observation post, which had sustained damage and was evacuated a few days ago, following heavy fighting in the nearby town of Al-Jamla. Russian Ambassador Vitaly Churkin, who holds the rotating presidency of the 15-nation Security Council this month, read a statement to reporters condemning the detention of the UN observers and demanding their release.
The members of the Security Council demanded the unconditional and immediate release of all the detained UN peacekeepers and called upon all parties to cooperate with UNDOF in good faith to enable it to operate freely and to ensure full security of its personnel.
Ambassador Churkin said his understanding of the situation is that no fighting took place between the UN observers and their captors, but that the armed men took over the UNDOF vehicles. UN peacekeeping chief Hervé Ledsous told reporters that it is a very serious incident, which is ongoing, and has mobilized all of the UN's teams. Without going into detail, he said negotiations are going on. He said the incident occurred in the very south of UNDOF's area of operations. The United Nations has not said what nationalities the peacekeepers are, but troops from Austria, Croatia, India, and the Philippines are part of the observer force. There are just over 1,000 UN troops in the Golan Heights, where the UN has monitored a ceasefire between Israel and Syria since 1974. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The deepening sectarian conflict in Syria is aggravating an already tense sectarian divide in neighboring Iraq. Edward Uranian reports from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Amateur video shows Syrian rebel fighters and Iraqi government soldiers clashing near the Rabia border post captured by rebels over the weekend. Later, Iraqi officials say at least 42 Syrian soldiers who had sought refuge in Iraq were killed in a well-coordinated ambush by Iraqi Sunni insurgents. The Monday attack in Iraq's restive western province of Anbar raised concerns that Iraq could be drawn into the Syrian civil war. Iraq's parliament speaker, Usama Nujafi, a Sunni, blasted the Iraqi army for allegedly taking sides in the conflict in Syria. He says that what allegedly took place along the border must be avoided, and the Iraqi army must not meddle in internal Syrian affairs, staying neutral and protecting the border so that Iraq's own deep internal conflict is not exacerbated by outside conflicts. Iraqi Sunnis have been holding mostly peaceful protests in the major Sunni population centers of western Iraq since late December. They are demanding that Iraq's Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki release Sunni prisoners and share political power with Sunnis, whom they complain are increasingly marginalized. In an interview last week, Mr. Maliki warned that if rebels win in Syria, it could destabilize the region. He stopped short, though, of expressing direct support for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who is from Syria's Shiite offshoot Alawite community.
فيما لو استطاعت هذه المعارضة الموجودة أن تحقق تقدماً وانتصاراً.
Mr. Maliki says that if the mainly Sunni opposition present on the ground triumphs in Syria, it will lead to civil war in Lebanon, divisions in Jordan, and a sectarian war in Iraq. For this reason, he warns the West not to listen to countries demanding the rebels be armed if it wants stability. Middle East scholar Fuad Ajami of the Hoover Institution at Stanford University sees in Mr. Maliki a strong Shiite sectarian bias that is pushing him to support Bashar al-Assad mostly on sectarian grounds.
Nouri al-Maliki and the Shia-led government have decided that the defeat of Bashar is a defeat for them. This has become this big Sunni-Shia fight. Some years back, I used to have fairly candid conversations with Nouri al-Maliki. And he looks at the region through a sectarian lens. He sees Turkey as a Sunni power, a neo-Ottomanist, if you will, strategy. And he sees the Saudis and the Gulfies as Sunni countries invested in the fall of his Shia-led government in Iraq.
But Middle East analyst Gary Sick says that Sunni powers like Saudi Arabia are furthering sectarian tensions in Iraq and promoting regional instability.
Saudi Arabia has never recognized. They have no ambassador in Baghdad. And because of the dissatisfaction with countries like Saudi Arabia, the Sunni leadership with the creation of a Shia government in Iraq, that started a process of vitriol that really is now getting worse and worse. And that is a kind of poison that runs into the whole Middle East system, that basically every country, every city, every family is being challenged to take a new look at itself in purely sectarian terms.
Sikh predicts drastic consequences if Sunni rebels are victorious in Syria.
One of the Iraqi ministers said over the weekend that the arms that were supplied to the insurgents in Syria, it was like supplying arms to insurgents in Iraq, because they were going to definitely make their way into Iraq. And the Free Syrian Army, or the opposition to Assad, is almost overwhelmingly Sunni, and they in many cases have tribal relationships that run right across the border into Anbar province.
A UN report issued in December described the fight in Syria as overtly sectarian. Anti-Assad rebel forces reportedly include Sunnis from Afghanistan, Libya, and other countries. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
A UN agency reports hundreds of thousands of Syrian children are missing out on school because of war and the damage and destruction of schools across the country. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations Children's Fund reports that nearly 2 years of war in Syria is having a devastating impact on the ability of children to get an education. UNICEF spokeswoman Marixi Mercado says one-fifth of the country's schools, an estimated 2,400, are damaged, and more than 1,500 schools are being used as shelters.
In cities where the conflict has been most intense, some children have already missed out on almost 2 years of schooling. Attendance has dropped to as low as 6% in Aleppo, 38% in Idlib, and 70% in Deraa. Some students often are just showing up twice a week. In areas hosting high numbers of displaced persons, such as Homs City, classes are overcrowded, sometimes hosting up to 100 students.
Mercado says more than 110 teachers and school staff have been killed in the conflict, and others are not reporting to work. She also notes that some schools are being used by armed forces in the conflict. Still, Mercado says Syrians want to see their children go to school.
The assessment underlined the enormous importance Syrian families place on education, with many parents singling out schooling as their top priority. It also notes that many parents are now reluctant to send their children to school because of fears for their safety.
Mercado says UNICEF is supporting more than 170 school clubs in several cities. She says the clubs give 40,000 children much-needed remedial education and allows them to take part in recreational activities. UNICEF aims to provide 1 million Syrian children with school materials, make it possible for displaced children to continue their education, and to offer 300,000 children psychological counseling. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Egyptians are bracing for further unrest ahead of more court sentencing related to last year's deadly football riot case. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett reports from Cairo.
In the past few days, at least 6 people have been killed and dozens more injured as tensions rise over the expected sentences Saturday of more than 50 men in the Port Said Stadium riot case. In the first round of sentencing in January, 21 men, most residents of Port Said, were condemned to death, sparking violent protests in the port city and other towns along the Suez Canal. The protests merged with anti-government actions across the country, marking 2 years since a revolution plunged Egypt into an era of uncertainty. While Saturday's sentencing is most likely to affect Port Said hardest, publisher Hisham Qassam warns it will exacerbate deep political divisions across the nation.
I don't think that the violence that will result from the ruling is going to be contained to Port Said in that case, but it seems to be spreading because of the deteriorating face of authority in Egypt.
President Mohamed Morsi and his government have been facing calls from street protesters and the opposition to step down, or at the least, form a more inclusive unity government to move through the current crisis. Tensions between the Islamist leader and his secular, nationalist, and anarchist opponents are compounding an economic crisis that risks putting the country into bankruptcy within months. Lines to buy gasoline, power cuts, and rising prices bring home the problems daily. Security concerns have forced key government offices to close. Political analyst and former intelligence officer General Sameh Saif al-Yazil says it's not clear how well the government, in particular the Interior Ministry, can maintain control.
Egypt now in the phase of fragile state, which is the last phase before collapsing the entire country. And I can see that in front of me.
Hopes that Egypt's political transition process would begin wrapping up next month with parliamentary elections were dealt a new blow this week with a court challenge to the proceedings. Even if the elections go ahead on time, some opposition parties have pledged a boycott. The unrest has sparked speculation in the Egyptian media that the military might intervene, as it did following the ousting of the old government. But publisher Qasim says that despite efforts by the Morsi government to get the military on its side, the armed forces may be reluctant to deploy.
If they do deploy, they will not deploy to keep President Morsi in power as much as they will deploy to regain stability in the country. And that might entail that they insist on Morsi resigning before they deploy to avoid being perceived as deploying to save an unpopular failed president.
The government hopes to reverse the slide by offering talks with the opposition and by receiving further financial help from such countries as Qatar and a loan from the International Monetary Fund. But the opposition has largely rejected Mr. Morsi's overtures as insincere, while the IMF deal would entail austerity measures and possible further unrest. There are few voices of optimism these days in the country, where some, like retired General al-Yazil, see the problems as having brought about a fundamental change.
Egypt has been known for decades that we are a very peaceful country and we're very moderate. Unfortunately, we are not moderate now and not peaceful.
Al-Yazil says his point of view makes him sad, but adds he's just trying to be realistic. Elizabeth Thau at VOA News, Cairo.
If you tuned us in Wednesday, you heard Michelle Dunn of the Hariri Middle East Center at the Atlantic Council express concern about the Obama administration's reaction to the situation in Egypt. Today, VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy asks what she thinks of President Barack Obama's call to Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, saying he has a responsibility to protect the democratic principles the Egyptians fought for.
I saw President Obama's call to President Morsi as perhaps the beginning of this broadening of the dialogue with Egypt and an expression of concern about the Egyptian economy is reaching a critical state. And I think President Obama's call acknowledged to President Morsi that the United States is concerned that Egypt will not be able to deal with its economic problems if there isn't a broader political consensus. We've seen a great deal of polarization in Egypt. The Egyptian government has to take some economic reform measures. They're widely for the most part accepted, you know, in Egypt what it is that has to be done. Still, it's not easy to do it. And the best way to do it is to have a broad political consensus, not just President Morsi and the Freedom and Justice Party trying to do this on their own. They have unfortunately alienated a lot of the other political forces, the non-Islamist political forces, and even some of the Salafi, for example, the Noor Party. And this is a mistake, I think, for President Morsi and his party to try to implement a broad reform agenda on their own, and I don't think it will succeed. And I think that's what President Obama was trying to say. Look, we want to see you succeed in this. We know you need to get your economy back on track, but that needs to go hand in hand with a more inclusive democratic process.
But on the other hand, there is a feeling that the Muslim Brotherhood knows how to warm up to the U.S. by confirming the importance of building a strategic partnership.
You know, it has been remarkable that in the short time since President Morsi won the election last June, that the Brotherhood in the United States, which had very, very limited contacts before that, have built this cooperative relationship. I think that's been built on two principles. One of them is that, so far at least, the Egyptian government has behaved certainly responsibly in terms of its handling of the relationship with Israel and the security in Sinai and Gaza and so forth. And the other thing is the economic reform issue. I think basically President Morsi and his government are in agreement with the International Monetary Fund and the international community about what needs to be done. Where there's less agreement, I think, is on the political issues. And I think there is growing concern in the United States that President Morsi has, tried to force through a constitution that did not have as broad political support as one would like a constitution to have, and that he is now sort of forcing the calendar toward parliamentary elections, despite the fact that there are a lot of objections from the opposition about the conditions under which the elections will be held.
But nevertheless, the United States' response to that was very little. I was in Egypt last month, and I detected a lot of conspiracy theories about the U.S. repeating the same strategic mistake of turning the other way as long as its interests are being served by the Egyptian president.
Well, I share that concern. I mean, that was certainly something that we said in the op-ed article in the Washington Post. But I think it's not too late. This is President Obama's second term. We have a new Secretary of State. I think he's concerned about this issue. So there's an opportunity now for a fresh look at the beginning of President Obama's second term and saying, you know, what is the United States doing in its policy toward Egypt? Do we need to adjust the policy a bit?
Michelle Dunn, Hariri Middle East Center Director at the Atlantic Council. We hope to bring you more of her remarks tomorrow about what the United States needs to do concerning Egypt. The United States has expressed concern about Iran's failure to address international questions about its nuclear program, saying Tehran is committed to deception, defiance, and delay. Joseph McManus, the chief U.S. envoy to the International Atomic Energy Agency, said Wednesday at a meeting in Vienna that instead of complying with its obligations, Iran has taken further provocative actions.
The time for action by Iran is now. There is no lack of clarity on what steps Iran has to take. There is no debate over requirements that it has to meet, and Iran has the capability and the ability to respond to the concerns that it has heard raised by the Board of Governors over the past 10 years that have been captured in 12 board resolutions that have been frustrated in a year and a half of discussion about a structured approach to meet concerns that have been raised about the possible military dimensions of Iran's nuclear program. Responsibility to respond to that concern lies directly with the government of Iran.
Iran denies it is developing nuclear weapons and says its nuclear program is solely for peaceful purposes. Ali Ashgar Salatini is Iran's ambassador to the IAEA.
I want to conclude by saying we are committed to continue our dialogue with the IAEA, and this commitment have been unwavering. But at the same time, we cannot give a blank check for our national security. No country would give a blank check.
IAEA Chief Yukika Amano said that without more cooperation from Iran, his inspectors cannot conclude that all nuclear material is for peaceful activities. Amano said further negotiations with Iran must proceed with a sense of urgency. This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.